everybody. Happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee with the Scene Stealers Podcast, here once again with my friends Eric Moline and Trey Hawk. We are here today to talk about a few things. We've got Jack Reacher. This is 40, the newest Judd Apatow movie, and Les Miserables, Eric and Trey's favorite musical of the year, if I'm not mistaken.
You're mistaken.
Oh, okay. We'll get to that in a minute. But the very first thing we wanted to talk about was this last weekend. We had our Kansas City Film Critics Circle vote. And some interesting things happened. So why don't you tell me what happened, Trey? I was too busy. I was zoned out on all the free food.
Yeah,
arcade.
I wondered why you even showed up.
Yeah.
All right. So the Kansas City Film Critics Circle, the second oldest critics circle in the U.S.
Next to New York.
Yeah. So we're a pretty prestigious bunch, and we all voted on our best of 2012. And The Master was our best, the best film as voted on by the Kansas City Film Critics Circle. But I do want to point out that it was a pretty contentious vote. It came down to a final round of voting. It was pretty evenly split with just a nod towards The Master. And Life of Pi was the runner-up. So I just wanted to mention that for all of those dissenting voters out there. I was pretty solidly in the master camp, so I was really happy. But since I was in the dissenting camp last year, you know, I just wanted to make sure to appease the beast and throw out a shout out to Life of Pi. Some other notables: Jennifer Lawrence won for Best Actress
by one over Kevin J. Wallace.
Which I mean, but I think that's a pretty exciting vote. Best actor was
Daniel Day-Lewis by one.
Yeah, over Joaquin Phoenix. Philip Seymour Hoffman pretty handedly took best supporting actor, best supporting actress, Anne Hathaway.
That was also that. I don't think we even needed to go to a second round of voting on
that.
Yeah,
it was
one.
Pretty
was
solidly Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
For Les Miserables. And you know, I think those are the big notables.
Biggest disappointment, like one that you wished had.
Sci-fi not going to Beyond Black Rainbow.
Yeah.
Okay.
and you're obsessed with that movie.
It's a great movie.
It's three quarters of a good movie.
It's a great movie throughout.
Right. We don't have time to talk about it. But
you
disappointment. My biggest disappointment was Argo winning Best Adapted Screenplay. That is the stupidest thing I've ever fucking heard of in my life. Seriously, the last half hour of this movie should disqualify it for winning anything. I mean, it's a by-the-books Hollywood thriller that takes a historical drama and then plugs it into this formula. And, I mean, really, they're fucking driving out on the tarmac, and that guy's going to get nominated for an Oscar to stop the plane. It's so dumb. It's dumb, people. You were manipulated. Anyway, whatever. Argo's just fine, but it's just fine. It's not
okay.
Oscar material. I mean, what else was in that category? Tony Kushner? Yeah, Lincoln was, you know, a pretty, it's a pre-approved movie. It's a prestige film right now, but Lincoln is light years better than Argo. And almost anything in that category. I think Silver Linings Playbook would have been a great, great adapted screenplay nominee.
Oh, and I agree.
My vote was for Killer Joe, and Michael Haneke's Amore is amazing. So anyway, whatever.
All right, well, I clearly opened a can of worms there. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, Eric. You were happy this morning, and I've kind of derailed that.
We should also mention that Joss Whedon beat Joss Whedon by one vote.
It's true.
In the sci-fi horror fantasy category.
Yep.
When Cabin in the Woods beat the Avengers.
Yep.
So.
And that was the only category that I really wanted to see.
Looper.
I wanted to see Looper get something.
Yeah.
And I love that sci-fi category because it's a chance to nominate or vote for kind of offbeat or weird.
Yeah.
Like
movies. Beyond the Black
Rainbow.
Non-awards
like, movies.
Yeah, like
there were some good genre movies.
That aren't
going
to go anywhere. Yeah. And you know, like I'm completely fine with Cabin in the Woods, but I wanted Looper to get recognized for something. So
I wanted Cloud Atlas, but I bailed right away
after
I saw there was not much support for it.
You jumped ship so fast. But anyway, we should move on and actually talk about movies that are in theaters this week. So let's start with Jack Reacher, which I keep saying it like that because it's that kind
the
of
Reacher.
Movie. It's that kind of movie where it's just it's okay.
Boy.
It's Tom Cruise. It's a Tom Cruise production.
Yes.
And the film is based on a series of books, a character in a series of books by the author Lee Child. This one is specifically based off the book One Shot. And Jack Reacher, as a character, is this drifter. In the books, he's I believe 6'5", and yeah, between 220 and 250, and blonde. And he's a former military policeman, a drifter, and he just kind of shows up and rights wrongs and then leaves town when the work is done.
Which is pretty much what he does in this movie.
Yeah.
So he's
yeah,
a one-man A-team.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Or Batman.
Yeah, but he's a big, menacing dude that just beats the shit out of people and sets things right.
But he's a brilliant investigator.
He's a brilliant investigator. He's got a soft spot for the ladies. So it's all this stuff together. And this movie, real quick, was written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie, who I think this is the first time he's directed since The Way of the Gun, which is one of my favorite little genre movies. And
we should mention he's the Oscar-winning co-screenwriter of The Usual Suspects.
Yeah, and he's written a few. He wrote last year's Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and he wrote Valkyrie. He's worked with Cruise several times. And
he
now
wrote
there's
The Tourist.
Yeah.
Which we don't talk about.
No. And then there's also talk that he might, depending on how this movie does, he might be the director for the next Mission Impossible movie. But that's a whole different can of worms I don't want to get into.
That'd be cool.
That would be cool. So the film, the best way I can explain this movie is, remember when they announced Ghost Protocol last year and a lot of the more snarky film bloggers were like, this is Tom Cruise's midlife crisis.
Yeah.
This is Tom Cruise's, like, he's just trying to prove that he's still got it, whatever. But it actually was a pretty good action movie
yeah,
behind it, you know? Like,
Ghost
it was
Protocol.
Big, and Brad Bird did a great job. It had a great supporting cast, and, you know, it gets a little Looney Tunes at the end, but I like the whole movie. I think it's great. And shot in IMAX, those huge sweeping shots in Dubai are amazing. This is Tom Cruise's midlife crisis. Jack Reacher is like it is the definition of his sort of midlife weirdness. First time we see him as a character, there's a woman who's at least 20 years his junior,
yeah,
in a thong, ass to the camera,
model hot,
putting a bra on,
yeah,
and he's laying shirtless on the bed watching TV. So that's so that's the first thing.
Yeah.
Then and this is hilarious. And to go with this real quick, I think the best thing this movie does, it is put together incredibly well in terms of like pacing and the montages and the way that I feel it's composed. I think it, for as pulpy and kind of dumb as it is in some ways,
mm-hmm,
I think the way that it's put together is very efficient and well done. But that means there are some montages to kind of get characters where they need to go. And so, like, the first Jack Reacher montage is him, like, getting his shit together, and he's going to leave Florida and go to Pittsburgh. And so, like, there are three different women that help him. Like, one is paying him out at Western Union. One helps him get clothes at Goodwill. One helps him buy a bus ticket. Every woman gives, I would fuck you glance.
Yeah.
Like, just one, two, three. And one is, like, a 70-year-old Asian woman behind the counter at Western Union, and she slides his
but
money across.
But there's a sparkle
and
in their eyes. Each one of them. Yeah.
So that's the intro to the character. Then later,
he's
like,
a lady killer.
He's intentionally shirtless later, and it doesn't look good. But the movie's trying to convince
well,
him. I mean, he looks
I'm
good.
Not going to comment on whether he looks good without a shirt off. But he's got his shirt off, and he's trying to pretend like it's normal.
Right.
And the girl is just kind of like, would you please put your shirt on? He's like, no, this is my only shirt.
This
deal
is
with
my
it.
Shirt.
Yeah. You're like, okay.
Yeah, he just washed his shirt in the sink so he can't wear
he just
it.
Has one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so there are several scenes. Basically, like, there are all these scenes where, like, women still want to fuck Tom Cruise.
Right.
Just in case you thought
so that's
that
the midlife crisis kind of portion.
And then you know, there's some other stuff, the combat stuff, the him. I mean, he took on this role that I don't think was, I mean, he's pretty much the exact opposite
well,
of
we
what
should,
the character is.
We should mention
for.
That you talked
but,
about the snark earlier in terms yeah. of Ghost Protocol. The snark for this movie is really at an all-time high.
Yeah,
people
for sure.
have been making fun of this film since they saw the opening trailer where
mm-hmm.
he beats up five dudes.
Mm-hmm.
And because Jack Reacher's 6'5", and everybody knows Tom Cruise isn't. Now, if you're asking me, are you able to accept Tom Cruise in this role in the context of the film, my answer is absolutely yes. I think that he does not come across as a short person or a weak person at all in this film. And that, right. yes, movie magic can do that for you. And Tom Cruise has been bigger than life since Top Gun. And so did they pull it off in this movie? Yes, I think they did. And haters are going to hate whatever. I mean, it's not like the Jack Reacher character is some, you know, subtle, you know, great creation of...
Yeah.
I mean it's an archetype, and he lives up to it in this movie.
But that aside, is this a good movie?
Well, we haven't even got to that yet.
Yeah, I mean,
so let's switch gears. I kind of spent too much time on him anyway, so that's my fault. So why don't you move us through towards the actual criticism of the movie?
You want to talk about the movie? Because I'd actually rather talk about all the things around it, and I know you don't want to.
Well, then, okay.
So I'll let you finish the movie.
All right, well, fine. So as a movie, it strives to – it splits the difference between being sort of a one-off pulpy kind of action movie mystery, and it spends
well plotted.
It spends a little too much time on myth making. It blows the ending pretty hard. There were some things I really liked about it. I was surprised again at how well it was put together in terms of the plotting, the pacing, the efficiency of the story, the smart use of edits and montages to sort of move things along at a brisk pace. The mystery set up so quickly and so well at the very beginning of the film, and then is sort of strewn along at a good pace.
The information withheld to the audience is perfect. It's just the right moment. It's really well plotted.
So, and that's totally McQuarrie. And so I really have to give it high marks for that. I can't get past the sort of the macho bullshit that's at the heart of the movie, the Tom Cruise stuff. I feel like if it had been a Steve McQueen movie, I would have been totally into it.
But they wouldn't have needed to do that if it was a Steve McQueen movie.
Right. That's what I'm saying. If it were a more casual delivery, right. You know, it feels like it's overcompensating.
What about Werner Herzog as the villain?
I was about to get to him. He should play a villain more often because he was terrifying. He was terrifying. But I'm stirring it out. You know, I got to give it a minor rock fist down. For as much as I loved how well it was put together, I couldn't really get past, especially if the ending had been stronger, I would have enjoyed it. But the last 15-20 minutes is kind of a disaster, and I just couldn't get past the Cruise stuff. I don't think it was believable, and that's not – I've not read any of the books. I've not listened to a lot of the
I haven't
sort
either.
Of
just
echo
within
chamber
the,
shit.
The film, yeah.
But,
sorry,
yeah.
Aaron. Where do you come down?
I'm giving this a minor rock fist up. And this will surprise you because everything that I will say after this surrounding it will not be about the film itself. But
it's part of this new feature we have called Let's Negate Our Own Opinions.
Exactly. Exactly. on its own, the film, I think, like I said, is a well-plotted thriller. It has some really great moments. There's one scene that's played for comedy where two guys come to beat Tom Cruise up in a bathroom.
Yeah, that was incredible.
It is incredible. It's one of those scenes where if you look back at the end of the year at specific scenes in films, moments that had you laughing or jumping or crying or doing something, that movie, that's that particular scene, I wanted to clap my hands. It was so well done.
I think you would have been shrieking, honestly, Trey, get that scene.
You would have loved it. It was so good. I mean, really, McQuarrie's talented. He does a great job with this really macho bullshit kind of a character.
Yeah.
But he also does a great job of making sympathy for the victims in this film. And and so that's going to be my lead in to talking about it. So this movie opens with a sniper. It opens with a shot of a rifle sights at somebody aiming them at a small child,
mm-hmm.
a mother, some business people.
A jogger,
just random people. And then he opens fire and kills five or six of them.
Five.
Okay.
And there's...
That's how the film opens.
Sorry. And they leave it. Well, they cut all the audio out so you just hear the breath. So it's
very effectively done. In any other circumstance other than less than a week out from a massive school shooting that has the country reeling, everybody in that theater would be tense because they're watching a well-put-together scene that has you on the edge of your seat.
Right.
But because of what happened, everybody in the theater gasped as soon as that target went on that little girl. And they go back to this scene, by the way, in the film. There's also a scene that takes place at a gun club. A number of plot threads that culminate in gun control issues and gun violence issues. That said, this movie is not smart enough to tackle any of that. Yeah. This is not, it's not designed to do that. This is just purely bad timing. But it does raise the question of whether our culture is so obsessed with gun violence that that it's part of the problem that leads people to do things like this. And I think that think what you will about Michael Moore, he addressed this years ago in his Oscar-winning documentary Bowling for Columbine, and I think it's absolutely 100% true. Mm-hmm. And we ignore it. We willfully ignore it. We're going to talk about Django Unchained next week, which is even more egregious, but also less egregious because it's this fantastical world. It's theatrical. It's theatrical. Yeah.
Right.
This movie is trying to be realistic in its depiction of these people being terrorized and this community living in fear.
Yeah.
And there are more people that pay for that, and more innocent people that pay for that in the film. And it's just, for anybody who's going to see this in the theater this weekend. And if you want your disposable entertainment, you'll get that. But I'm also saying that you're going to get and I know everybody felt it. There was not one person in the theater who didn't have that tragedy on their mind when that scene came up. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I would love to just say this is, you know, what it is and not talk about it, this weekend especially, it was tough to watch. And it did bring me out of the film. And the way that the filmmaker was intending it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really effective.
So, but that said, I'm and the funny thing is I'm the one bringing it up. I'm also the one giving the film a good review. I think Tom Cruise has good quality control as a producer. I think he chooses projects well, and I think that he did a good job choosing McQuarrie for this.
Yeah.
And may or may not have been the best person to be cast in this. Mm-hmm. Maybe Channing Tatum would be better in 20 years, but I thought they pulled it off with a surprising sense of humor, and and that's about it. I do think they fumbled the end with the Herzog thing at the end with the showdown. Just because it just kind of happens, it's done, and then they go back to the myth making, and we don't want to blow that. But Jack Reacher's not as bad as it could have been, for a piece of disposable trash, it was pretty fun.
And the car chase was amazing.
Yes, that was the other scene that really, that was really good.
I don't know what they did for that. Like, I don't know if they used new rigs or I'm not sure how they.
It was almost like it was mounted on the dashboard.
Yeah.
It was zooming in and then zooming out and swirling and going and looking at the other cars coming into it.
Yeah, but even then, I don't know if they were using wide angle close ups or what they were doing, but man, they were just. Like so tight on those cars and such an enclosed.
This is one of those car chases where it's not just boxes moving around on a track. Mm-hmm. You see the actors and they're looking at each other while they're ramming into each other and running into each other, and you can see the faces and things. It was like really impressive.
It was a really solid chase. But speaking of like blown endings or wide angle close ups. Should we talk about Les Mis next? Do we want to save that?
This is
40.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so Jack Reacher opens this weekend. Is 40. Also opens this weekend. This is Judd Apatow, written and directed film. Judd Apatow, of course, is the producer, director, writer, comedy king at this point, who was responsible for The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and Funny People. As in the films that he wrote and directed, and then produced a number of films from Bridesmaids to Superbad to pretty much any comedy that comes out these days.
Pineapple Express, or co-wrote it.
Yeah, Pineapple Express. I think he produced that one as well. Yeah. But Judd Apatow is a major force in comedy thanks to those films. And what this movie allows him to do is explore two characters from Knocked Up that were involved in what I thought was a great subplot in that film. Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann play a married couple who have two kids. And in Apatow's case, they happen to be very close to him personally. His real-life wife, Leslie Mann, plays the wife, and his real-life kids are the kids of the couple. And so this film focuses solely on them and their midlife crisis as parents, and also as Paul Rudd, the head of the household, is dealing with the current economy. In his case, he's a record executive who started his own label and is struggling to keep their house and tell the truth to his wife. And that really is the only conflict, the only conflict that kind of carries through the entire film, besides just dealing with the fact that they're being old.
Well, they got to deal with their shitty parents
too. Right, and they both have shitty parents. Paul Rudd's father is played hilariously, by Albert Brooks, who's amazing.
He was my favorite part of the whole movie.
Yeah, sure. And added a lot to the film in terms of dialogue and things like that. And John Lithgow is Leslie Mann's father. But what I wanted to say was, before we get into the criticism of the film, is that it is the way Apatow writes is he comes up with these ideas from his own life and from his friends' lives and things that he notices, and then he just jots all these scenes down and says, oh, this would make a great scene. So really what This Is 40 feels like is a collection of truthful, funny moments from his life. And I think the more personal he gets and the more specific he gets, the easier it is to relate to, which is really weird because you would normally think that, you know, in music you write these big hit songs, they have big stupid lyrics, and people plug their own lives into them. Apatow's strategy is to get very specific and mention all kinds of real-life things.
That's what comics do.
Yeah,
You know, like a good comic tells a story about their own life, but you just go, oh, yeah, I know exactly what that
– Yeah. Exactly. And there's a scene in this movie where Paul Rudd is trying to explain why he's passionate about music. The song that he chooses to air guitar to and get all emotional to – is an Alice in Chains song, which really rubbed me the wrong way because that doesn't work for me. But I love the sentiment of the scene.
And this is in front of his wife. His wife and his two daughters. He's trying to get them into music.
He picks
The Rooster.
The Rooster, which is I hate that fucking song. But it's all maudlin and it's all and he's trying to say this is what I feel like. And they want to jump around and listen to Katy Perry and Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
And it seems like that and that kind of specificity
mm-hmm.
that make this film, for me, very possibly the funniest movie I've seen all year. I know this is not going to relate to everybody, and one of those people is Trey Hawk, who made it about 40 minutes into the film and then shut it off. Yeah. So Trey can't give us a full review.
And we were going to theater. He went and complained.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. But here's the other thing. I'm going to issue another caveat. I know this movie's not for everybody,
mm-hmm.
but I think that it has a lot of truth in it. I know it does because I related to a lot of it, and I don't even have kids. And I think that his style of humor
mm-hmm.
Is sometimes bludgeoning to people, and I like the way that the verbal diarrhea just kind of comes out, and people say what they think, and it opens up a whole can of worms. For instance, the scene where he talks about killing his wife. And vice versa, the one where she talks about killing him.
How they do it?
Yeah, and I thought that was great. So now I'm going to turn it over to Trey to totally eviscerate This Is 40.
I'm not going to totally eviscerate it. You know, I'm a dissenting voice when it comes to Knocked Up. I think Knocked Up's basically a vulgar, funny film that. Is the vulgar and the vulgar comedy is used to cover up or mask what is a ridiculously sentimental plot, and
which all his movies are pretty sentimental.
Yeah, sure. No, and
this one is too.
And to me, there's really just this, you know, odd tonal thing going on with Knocked Up. It stays with this here. I find This Is 40, you know, kind of like almost unwatchable because, obviously I only made it 40 minutes through, I had an awards season screener of it.
We had a lot of movies to watch.
To watch. I got about 40 minutes in, and I was just like, there's no way this is getting any better. And I have – my time is worth so much more than this. And I stopped it.
Yeah.
And honestly, I have absolutely no intention of going back to it. You know, that there are some cases, like in past years, where it was like, hey, I know this isn't going to win, but it's pretty good and it's got my interest, but I'm crunched for time. And then I'll go back and pick them up. I have no interest at all.
So what? Why? Why no interest?
You know, the jokes to me didn't feel like jokes. And
that's why I like them, though.
Right, but that's the thing, is if it's being sold as a comedy. And I actually disagree with you. Apatow is on record as saying there is no specific truth to this. There is only emotional truth to this. So none of these things actually happened. There was never a discussion with his wife. He has said that. He goes, none of this stuff happened.
Right, but he also said that the more specific he gets in his scenes, the more emotional truth is uncovered. In other words, making them about without putting the specific instances in there, whether they happened or not, he's making them more real by using all of the.
But your comment was is that he's taking bits out of his life and out of the lives of friends around him.
Yes.
He didn't do that here. He took the emotional, like, he's like, oh, well, these feel like stuff that happened to me.
I used the word specific, and what I didn't mean to infer that the moments themselves were specific,
I think
but they were full of specific detail.
I think this film lacks that type of specificity, and that's why it feels bland.
Which type?
All right, so to give you an example, I feel like almost every scene with the girls feels like an aside and a total distraction from the film. It feels watered down. It feels like safe versions of kid conversations or kid fights or kid disputes or kids loving each other.
Well, back to what you said earlier, his daughter is obsessed with Lost, actually. And so all of that kind of stuff is right out of...
I mean, that's and I understand. I get that. That's easy. I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that it's just like, it feels like bland... anything. You know, you could easily just replace kids one by one and it feels the same. You know, and I found the kid talk largely uncompelling.
I am totally in the opposite camp from you.
Yeah, and that's totally fine.
So where do you come down Rockfist wise?
Are we done?
No, I just want to know.
Oh.
You haven't said it yet.
This is a solid Rockfist up. Oh yeah. No, I think...
Because I actually have to weigh in, because I watched the whole thing, too.
Yeah, I think this movie's great. I'm excited to watch it again when award season is all finished. I will go back to this. I'll probably buy it on Blu-ray and devour all the deleted scenes and everything.
Leslie Mann's nipple in HD.
You know
I'm
what?
Really,
that scene was devastating in the movie where she comes in and she wants to have sex with him. And I mean, she is a sexy woman, and that is pretty insane to think that he wouldn't want to.
I think what's going on here
but that works in the movie.
You have a Leslie Mann complex.
I think Leslie Mann's great.
It?
Yeah, but especially in this film, actually, and I voted for her in the Broadcast Film Critics Circle. We had a comedy actress category, and I voted for her. I thought she was in the best performance in a female performance in a comedian. Well, no one's won it, but they had nominations, and she's nominated for it. So, I think that's great.
You know who steals the whole movie is Melissa McCarthy. Like her,
well,
she's got one scene, and it's the funniest part of the entire movie.
It's really funny, but it's pretty over the top too.
No, it's so funny that it's the only outtake that they put at the end of the movie as just her riffing. And because they shoot this scene where she's in the principal's office with the Leslie Mann and Paul Rudd's characters, and because something's happened between
Leslie Mann yelled at a kid and called him Tom Petty lookalike.
Called him a young Tom Petty. Anyway, so there's been an altercation. The mother of this kid is Melissa McCarthy, and the way they filmed the scene, they had multiple cameras going. So basically, it just allowed each of the actors to improv as much as they wanted to, and then in editing, they would kind of build the scene. But it also, because there are multiple cams, the actors that you know aren't on camera, or maybe it doesn't matter if they're on camera because they're trying to just shoot one actor's delivery, can break and they don't have to cut and scrap the whole scene. Mm-hmm. So it's just this shot of Melissa McCarthy doing her thing and being hysterical, and Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann are just like sitting feet from her, just falling apart. Like they're crying, they're laughing so hard, and she's just still going. Like she's just, it's great. It's the best. It's the funniest outtake I've seen, maybe. Oh God, easily this year in a long, long time. But her scene's the funniest part of the movie. I didn't come down on it the way that you did, and I don't really know why Eric come down on it the way that you did. I definitely am more in Trey's camp than I am in yours. I was not compelled by any of the conflicts the film tries to set up. I wasn't. I mean, I
having to tell the truth to his wife and having that father that he's got and those three kids that his father treats like crap, just
they
like
all
treated
just,
him.
It, no, it just it all they all just felt like it all just felt like I don't know. It just sort of flat characters. I didn't really have. I know. Go ahead and do whatever. I wasn't compelled by any of it.
I should mention that these jokes were written for me. I should mention that I am the target audience.
It's true. It says
here.
Special.
This is,
yeah,
this is no.
Credits,
I mean, seriously,
Eric
when you see
credits.
A film that has as many specific pop culture references and cultural differences between
but,
where you are in your life and
I
other
don't
people
feel
are,
like I don't. That's I, you know what? But I don't think it's but, a cultural thing. I really don't. I don't think
there's
it,
a reason that John Nickum and Aaron Webber and myself laughed nonstop throughout this entire film, and you guys didn't. And I think part of that has something to do with the fact that
you
that
and Trey
we were
the same age.
All
I know, but we were all
awkward parents,
obsessed with music, growing up thinking the same things were important. And I
grew up during whatever.
Well, I'm just saying, there's something something very specific about this that appeals to me.
It
I'm
didn't.
Admit
it didn't.
That.
That's what I'm saying is, and that's why I'm saying I'm coming down on Trey's side. I didn't feel like there was that specificity. I felt like it was really. It's hard for me to put a finger on it, but I just wasn't compelled by any of it. Their conflicts, even though I understand what they were and what that meant, I wasn't really drawn in or compelled by any of them. The money thing, the bad dad thing, the bad parents thing, them fighting for no fucking reason, and it just becomes two people that are making each other miserable for no reason at all.
That's called a relationship.
And so like just dealing with that and trying to watch it, I don't just get along. You know?
Okay,
like,
so I'm gonna have to. I'll get to this at least then, since we got
to
wrap this up.
Yeah. I give it real quick. Minor down.
Okay. Yes, it's too long. I even felt it while I was enjoying and laughing at nearly every single scene in the film. I knew it was a little bit.
And
too
it makes
long.
Some of the jokes just not punch. Honestly, the length makes some of the big payoff jokes not punch either. And then he puts a fucking bogus pseudo climax on it that doesn't go anywhere. And then the other thing that's really weird, and
I
know
they have been married a while, so pseudo climaxes might be as
that's
as
true
as it gets.
Yeah, and the other thing that I thought was really weird, and I don't know if you made it far enough in, but he being Apatow, and I know it's kind of part of the character, but he really, his camera really, really fetishizes Megan Fox in this movie.
Oh, yeah, she's supposed to.
I
absolutely
know, but like,
I mean, she's the younger, like, I love
but I mean
fact
to
that,
the point that like we're trying to wrap it up, but yeah, it was. I was like, man, he is really like this. He's at the point where Michael Bay would be like, dude, let's maybe dial it back a little bit.
Well, Paul Rudd's character is supposed to feel that as well, and I think that Megan Fox is used to great effect in this movie. Honestly,
yeah.
I
mean, oh, she is. I'm not complaining.
And I love where they went with her character. I love the conversation that Leslie Mann had with her. The only thing that doesn't ring true about that whole relationship is that Leslie Mann is incredibly hot. At 40. If Leslie Mann was a more average-looking, middle-aged woman, mm-hmm. her jealousy and whatnot and all that kind of stuff, that would be more realistic. The other thing that's not realistic is that a guy who works at or used to work at a major label would start an independent label in the middle of this horrible music business future right now and then sign somebody like Graham Parker, who I also enjoy and is another reason that I like the movie, and think that record would sell anything and base paying the rent or the mortgage on his really big house on that fact. So there are some things, that and the length and some of the pacing issues. But what the last thing I want to say about this film, and the reason it's a solid rock fist up, is the scenes are so full of great little truths, nuggets of relationship truth, and so consistently funny that even as a collection of sketches,
yeah,
this film works for me.
All right. Let's end it there.
Okay.
And let's move on to another one that I can't wait to hear you guys talk about.
The Miserables.
Tom Hooper's.
Now you've seen it as well.
The Miserables.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You just want it.
I just, you guys, I feel like are going to spit all of the bile, and I'm just going to be like, hey, that's a lot of bile. I agree
that's
with
that's a
them.
Whole lot of bile.
I agree with all of it.
But there's whole a lot of bile.
Tom Hooper, welcome, British Steven Spielberg.
Really?
I think so.
After two films, you're going to call him the British Steven Spielberg.
But here's why. I'll qualify it, because I don't really feel that way. But one of the things that Steven Spielberg has historically done is, because I think Steven Spielberg is a capable director.
Just tray out of Spielberg.
No. This is a simple qualification. If you'd let me have my 15 seconds, it would have been over. If you prod me, it will become an hour and 15 minutes. He picks subject matter that is beyond reproach. And so then, whatever he does with it, people will be okay with it.
It has the stamp of prestige.
Kind of, yeah. So Hooper has done this King's Speech,
yes,
which is about a stuttering ruler,
yes,
and
learning
to
deal with the common man,
exactly,
to get his help.
And but he has to deliver this, you know, in immense,
yeah,
speech at a very specific time in history, and it's hard to attack or prod that subject matter. It makes you seem mean-spirited and whatever. I think Hooper has done the same thing with Les Mis. Mm-hmm. I mean, this opera is so beloved. And, I mean, kind of across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are 30-year-old dudes. That,
yeah, but it's beloved in the same way that Cats and The Phantom of the Opera are beloved.
Oh, no.
It's Trey Parker's favorite musical.
Yeah, oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. He cries
every time he watches it.
It's beyond. Cats is, even with an
But those are the trifecta of this British producer that brought these films and revolutionized Broadway again and made tourists, yeah, want to come to New York.
Musicals. You know. Not films. But
I'm talking about the musicals.
I think Les Mis is commitment. Mm-hmm. Like the commitment from its fan is bigger than Phantom. It's bigger than Cats. I think it's. I think Les Mis is beloved.
So let's talk about this sacred cow.
And so what I think has happened is going to happen with Les Mis is that because it's got a built-in audience. Because the songs are there and they're well executed, they're good, they're earwormy. I don't think it's going to matter one bit about the effectiveness of the direction, the quality of the acting, all of that,
yeah,
which I think is subpar.
I do too.
Yeah. But people are just going to bring in their Les Mis baggage, walk out and go, that was a stunning masterpiece. And it doesn't matter whether it is or not.
Right.
Right. My point is it's not. I think that Hooper actively works to visually undermine what the power of Les Mis is.
You don't like wide-angle close-ups? I don't understand.
I think wide-angle close-ups
like
are incredible.
There's like 450.
That's all that he does. And I think that's a mistake. You know, he has this huge budget, this
gorgeous
enormous
sets,
production
these
design.
Gigantic productions.
Yeah.
And just wide-angle close-ups.
Give us
infuriated.
Give us an actual wide shot.
I was just
don't
watching
just...
it. Do we have gorgeous sets? Or do we have, just let's be honest
composited
about this.
Stuff, computer-generated
this,
things.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
This
yeah.
movie is
no.
full of CGI production design that I thought was frankly distracting,
yeah,
and
yeah,
and subpar.
It is, and I mean,
just
but I mean, I, that's the thing is that all you have to do is build a great set,
right? Would it kill him to do just like a couple of big crane shots and swoop down in on the?
He did.
He does one or two, but just as transitional elements.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Not to like live in. And not within the context of the song. It's always moving one from
right.
one song
yeah.
to the
yeah.
other.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they're just transitional.
His strategy was to have the actors film on set, which, by the way, it's been thrown out in featurettes, advanced featurettes for the film, that this is a revolutionary process. It's not. People have done it before.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bogdanovich did it in 1975.
Yeah.
And people have done it before
and
that.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about, all the actors sang live on set.
Rather than lip syncing to a pre-recorded track, as is the standard.
Which I think is still, even though you're 100% right, I think that it's being made to sound like if this is the first time it's happened. But I still think it's impressive that he had him do that.
It may have been a good idea for a musical.
Right.
But I don't think it was a good idea for this musical, and here's why. Because he's got these actors. The songs that they are singing are not intimate.
No.
They're not small songs. Every single song ends up being this huge, bombastic, overblown, melodramatic moment.
Right.
And to have the camera zoom up into their face in one long, unbroken take, and have that actor turn on the waterworks and put all of their emotion into it as if we were sitting in the balcony, and to have us right there in their fucking face for the whole song, not only does it diminish the power and make it seem actorly and stagey when it's supposed to be seeming realistic, but it just numbs you at a certain point. You can't take it anymore. And so when you take all those individual scenes, I talked about This Is 40, how the scenes themselves were really funny.
Little vignettes.
And that made the movie for me. There's 50 musical numbers in this film. They added an extra one. So there's 49
God.
In the play.
I was saying, could we get
I was wondering
more?
Where it was.
Could we get an even 50?
But there's 50 of them in here, and the cumulative effect of this this strategy repeated throughout the film, and the fact that the plot itself is recycled every 40 minutes. Where it ends, where there's a big outpouring of emotion, a lot of misery, a lot of heartbreak, an extended high note, a climax, a character death, and then a rousing chorus where everybody sings. That's basically repeated four times throughout the film. It just serves to make the entire thing this alienating piece of shit.
Well, it's like you just have been hit over the head with a blunt object.
I never entered it. I just kept it at arm's length the whole time.
Right, I agree. Yeah. But it didn't even take me until the third musical number. It was with the very first one where I was like, why? The music...
What?
Yeah, the music supplies the emotional content because this was written for the stage.
Right.
So we have to project to the last row so that that person feels the emotional content of that tiny person on
stage. And the actors are still acting like
that. And so the music provides the emotional content, which is why Hooper should have opened up as far as his compositions, let that person exist in a wider shot, knowing that the power of the music is going to carry the emotional content.
Right.
When you push, you're right, when you push right into a close-up and you have this highly emotionally charged music with this, like, tearful close-up, it's too on the nose. It's too, like, the visuals are too heavily and too forcefully reinforcing the emotional content of the music. And every single time I was like, I know, I get it. I get it. I'm supposed to feel terrible for this dying prostitute.
It's a really...
I understand. She's singing that to me, Tom Hooper.
That's part of the
problem. I don't need to be in her syphilitic face. I get it.
Another strategy that I thought that didn't work was maybe having some moments between the songs would have helped us relate to the characters a little bit better.
I think you're critiquing source material.
I know.
And I think that's what I'm trying to stay away from.
Right.
Is like, hey, I'm just going to go with the fact that this is going to be as strict an interpretation of Les Mis as we can get.
Plays and films are different things.
I totally get that.
I'm just saying maybe they should have cut out some of the songs.
Yeah, maybe they should have actually done an adaptation.
Yeah, and helped us relate to some of these characters and give them some moments instead of having them string this sung dialogue together, which seems to exist only to connect one scene to the next.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. But if they're not going to do that, I still think Hooper could have made this a more effective film, even if he was going to stick strictly to Les Mis.
I agree.
For me, it never went beyond a bunch of people dressed up in costumes on a CGI set singing about revolutionary France, but I didn't believe the relationship between Hugh Jackman's character Valjean and the daughter, the proto daughter, or whatever you want to call it, the adopt Cosette, who is the main miserable.
The main miserable.
Like, there's nothing between him and the adult version of her, played by Amanda Seyfried, to make me think that there was ever a relationship there, other than the fact that they're telling us over and over that there was.
Yeah.
And then the love triangle between the revolutionaries and Cosette being one of them was so ridiculous. I understood that, that Samantha Bark's character was in love with Eddie Redmayne, and that was clear. But why Cosette was in love with him wasn't. And then we're
supposed
to... Well,
then they saw each other across a park.
Okay, well, it's... So already...
I don't see why that's hard.
You hate Romeo and Juliet?
I don't want to critique the source material again, but it seems like I'm going to, is that already they're at a disadvantage for this movie, I feel, in that certain parts of the melodrama just don't add up. And I know that it's beloved by audiences, and maybe it's easier to accept on a big stage, but in a movie... We, especially a 2-hour and 40-minute movie, or 2-hour and 30-minute movie,
every
we
minute
need this.
That, yeah.
We need these characters to work for us so that we can get invested in it. And I've never been outside a film so quickly and never been able to get back in. And for me, it was the moment after the first 40 minutes when Anne Hathaway delivers her Oscar-winning performance of I Dreamed a Dream. And from then on out, it was just like... Oh, wow, we got to this point already. A character I just met 10 minutes ago, I'm supposed to be, you know, in tears over, and it just wasn't working at all.
Yeah,
and you know,
I think it's entirely Hooper's fault too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. So where do we come down? Rock Fist.
Way down for me. I think my opening paragraph is this is like Twilight for adults. And I put adults in quotation.
Well, that's funny because, I mean, well, go ahead, Trey.
For 60 to 70 year
olds. It's just like, we're pushing a rock up a hill here.
Yeah.
Because everybody who wants to see it is already
loves
it.
Well, it's like I said, it's got its built in crowd. Yeah. As long as the music is there, people walk out and go, it was a masterpiece.
It's a theater kid's wet dream.
Yeah.
It absolutely
is. But I mean, I would say go and see it in the theater.
Well, yeah, if you're going to see it.
I mean, it's going to be more powerful there.
Yeah. So, Trey.
Minor down.
Yeah, I got to go minor down instead of all the way down. The only reason is because of Hathaway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, her performance is incredible, but like it's still overblown.
It would be incredible if she was on Glee for 10 minutes, right? I mean, that's all it is. That's what I'm trying to say is that...
this is Glee.
Maybe it's Glee for adults.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, it really isn't for adults.
No.
I guess that's my entire point is this... This melodrama is half
emotionally stunted grown-ups. It's,
I don't know. I mean, we're just alienating every single person listening to this right now. Yeah. But it's I'm not the target audience, and I don't understand the target audience. How's that?
That is fine.
That is acceptable.
I accept that.
All right. Well, we're gonna end it on that very low note. So with one last wide angle close up, we'll be back next week with Django Unchained. And
Christmas.
Yeah. So we'll all be doing Christmas stuff. In the meantime, good weekend, and we will see you next week.